It is good to be here. I would like to take about 15 minutes and kind of go around the room. And good to see you, and good to see you, and good to see y'all, but we don't have time for that. I got to kind of make a little fun of Ronnie, though, my brother, fellow historian. You know, I got a call yesterday. Dave Johnson's not here today. It's his 32nd anniversary. I said, take your wife to the conference, but somehow that didn't fly. But Ronnie stood up here and cried like a girl yesterday morning about three empires. The way I do math, Ronnie, 606 to 332. 606, Babylon takes Jerusalem. 332, Alexander's dead. That's and right in the middle of that, you've got so it's nothing, 330 years. Rome can't clear their throat in 330 years. So talk about time moving. Now, I'm guessing I didn't get to finish yours. I guess that's so you missed a little bit. You got Babylon done, I guess. Did you get Persia done at all or not? Okay, just jot down the names Darius and Cyrus the Great and Cambyses 1 and 2, especially 2. Basically, they whipped the Babylonians, took control of what you and I know as everything from about the Balkans down around the northern part of the land of Canaan. Didn't hold it all that long. Here comes Alexander, 325 or so, kicks them all to the curb, winds up taking the capital city of Babylon, which would have been Shinar, I guess, as his capital city. And then, because he dies, and they divided up four ways, the Greeks do, the Ptolemies and Seleucids, the two we care about, Canaan, the Seleucids having the Syria area and Canaan, and then the Ptolemies having what we know as Egypt. So there, we're done. As a matter of advertisement, you can come down here for free and go to school for 2 years, and Ronnie will teach you a lot of stuff, Book of Daniel, and I'll be working some of that. I do the ancient history courses here in between the Testaments, so we can do a lot of detailed stuff. But that fourth empire, even in the Book of Daniel, and by the way, you don't need a Bible for this class. That wasn't my design, but that's the assignment I've got. These boys make fun of me about doing too much other kind of preaching and not covering my material sometime on this history stuff. But Rome was unique even among the four beasts, a diverse beast, something different even among the beasts, different description. And that somewhat strong, somewhat weak, they talk about the bottom part of the image there in Daniel 2. So it's very unique. It's unique across the board. It is unique in that Rome existed for over a third of human history. We're going to start in 753 and run to 1453. That's 2,000 years. The church has been here 2,000 years, about 5 years from now. And the Roman church has been here 1,700 plus. They've been here the whole time the church has been here. They've been here. The Roman Empire and its influence is still here. Our government, our religions, our concepts, our culture, we are as Greco-Roman as if we lived on the peninsula of Italy ourselves when it comes to our thought processes. We all live in the shadow of Rome to this good day. And the way mankind is, it won't go away. Part of which is because of the mindset of the Romans, what they valued, what they ingrained in their people, and what they ingrained in us. 753 B.C. would be the traditional start date, September the 2nd to be exact, whenever Romulus founded the city of Rome. Now, the legend, and the legends are important. Listen, something doesn't have to be true, real. Let that sink in. You know, the ethos of nationalities, the legends that we grow up on, they do impact and shape and formulate what's in our mind. We live in Texas. There's not a place on the earth that we're tied to the legends of the Rangers, the legend of the Alamo, the of Sam Houston. We got a statue down here you can't hit with a rock to Sam Houston on Highway 45, don't we? Right over here. Wherever I'm pointing, wherever Huntsville lives in this building. That matters to a Texas boy, doesn't it? You know, because you feed on, there's an image you've got to live up to. There's an ideal, a man's man, a Texas man. I know you Okies are in here too, so we'll throw y'all in there. But you get the idea. I grew up on stories of John Paul Jones, I have yet begun to fight, and Abraham Lincoln's speeches, and George Washington, and Thomas Jefferson, and of course being from the South, Stonewall Jackson, and Robert Lee, and so forth. You know, you see these principles and ideas that a man should grab. So the legend of the birth, Rhea, mother, the Romulus, the daughter of, or I guess it's Numitor, the king of Alba Longa, was there in that area. That's north part of Italy, by the way. She has these twin sons, sired by Mars himself, the god of war. Now, you already see this? Divine beginning. Divine right, you know, to prosper. The idea of being the sons of the gods. She was a Vestal Virgin for him. It's false. It's not true, but it's the legend. She has twins. Her uncle took the throne away from his brother, and he puts a death sentence on those two twin boys. So the servants are told to take them out and kill them. The servants take them out, put them in a basket, push them out in the Tiber River. It takes them off. It comes to the shoreline there around the Palatine Mountains. That's one of the cities that Rome sets on, one of the mountains it sets on. The boys are crying. A she-wolf comes up, a nursing female wolf, and she lets them nurse. And she kind of gets them by a tree, and she's protecting them until Faustulus, the shepherd, comes, finds them, takes them home to his wife, and they raise them. Now, see, you're getting into the mind of Rome. By the way, she was the granddaughter of Aeneas. You know, her father, the king of Alba Longa, was a descendant of Aeneas, who was one of the survivors of the city of Troy. So they're hearkening back to the Trojan-Greek war on the one hand, the Mars god on another hand, destined to survive, destined to be tough, raised by a shepherd, common sense, working people, dirt under the fingernails. Rustic. Rome was rustic, practical. They took pride in that. Now, when those two boys grow up, they hear about what's going on back home. They go back to Alba Longa, and they depose their uncle, and they give the throne back to their grandfather, but they don't want to live there. They want to go make their own way. They go back to the area where they were saved from the shoreline. They get into a big argument over which mountain to build the city on, which hill. And it's not called Rima. It's called Rome. So Romulus kills his brother Remus and founds the city of Rome on one of those hills. Now, when you actually look archaeologically, that's about the right timeline, by the way. 750 B.C. is about right. But the idea there, from a historical standpoint, there were villages on most all of those hills. You got, for defensive reasons, as far as protecting yourself, and they're all in the Tiber River. You got water, and that Tiber, you can actually get to both oceans. You know, Italy's pretty narrow. That's a pretty good spot to be. So there were people there. But apparently a man named Romulus did found a city named Rome, and he was a pretty good first king. He does a lot of towns out, puts together the government, winds up taking the highest ranking 10, called patricians, but the big landowners, oligarchy basically, forms what we call the Senate. He was the monarch. He was the king. The reformer in many ways in what he was doing there as the king. Now, they had shortage of women at one occasion. So what he does, he throws a big feast. The Sabaeans. Now, when you hear Rome, I say the word Rome, and even me, Roman Empire especially, that big circle of red, right? Taking all that area. That's not Rome. Rome is that little bitty dot on the Tiber River above Magnus Graecia, which is Greater Greece. That's the lower, if that's a boot in your mind, the boot of Italy, that's from the ankle down. That's Greece. And then the part that runs along that western shoreline, that's Latium. That's where the Latins were. And then where those mountains are that run across that ridge, like a hog back there right down the middle, that's where the Samnites were. Then across on the other side up north is where the Etruscans were. Now, the Etruscans are pretty highbrow. That's a pretty significant culture, very similar to Greece. There's some argumentation back and forth as to which one developed some of those things first. Was it Etruscan art and architecture and engineering, or was it Greek? But that's another discussion. Well, Rome's right in the middle of all that. So they don't have enough women. So he throws this party. Well, there's another tribe between the Latins and the Samoans called the Sabinians. Is it the sobbing women on some of the comedy stuff about that? He throws a party, and what they do, they kidnap all the women, all the single girls, and take them as wives. Well, their daddies, of course, go home, get their weapons, and come back to fight a war. And the Sabine women run there between the fathers and brothers who have come to get them, and the husbands, they love both of them. At least they love one of them. They don't want to see a war, and they beg for mercy. They stay, and that's how you get the female side, the women that came into the play down there, that part of formulating what we know as Rome. So, of course, Romulus being who he was toward the end of his life, he's doing so well. They've begun to solidify things there. A big thunderstorm comes up. Lightning bolt hits him. He's taken to heaven. So Jupiter takes him home. So that's kind of the element of Romulus as far as the founding of Rome. The elements of truth in that, they were a very practical people. They actually saw themselves, that's why I mentioned Texas, as tougher, could go longer, could go further, as disciplined, not as indulgent. They didn't drink like some of the other countries. They didn't get themselves out of it. They didn't lay around, you know, eating high-calorie food and doing nothing. They took pride in labor and in production and in building. And that is a core principle that is going to carry Rome a long, long way. And when that begins to diminish, Rome begins to diminish. So that is a founding principle. There are seven monarchs. There are 3 points in this lesson. You guys at school, you need to know the most important two things when you turn around to preach every time. Who is your audience and what is your point? So that you know, I know who you are. You're here for a reason to study this week. This class really has 4 points in it. We had the first 3 empires yesterday. You've got Rome today. I think tomorrow we do the time of Christ. And I think Saturday is the Herods. Great lessons. All those are really good material. But you have to know what your point is. My point, what I'm doing right now, what I anticipate doing, is a survey of Roman history, just like I would start in Genesis and Malachi in about 40 minutes and give you a running tabulation of the Old Testament. And the purpose is to understand what's going on that timeline. So that's what's happening here. There are 7 kings or 7 monarchs during this time. By the way, there's no clock in this building, just so y'all know. So I have no idea where I am. All right, I know you got me, but I don't want 5 minutes. And I haven't even got to Caesar yet. I need a clock up here. Somebody's got a watch. I'll take it. All right, so the second king is Numa. He was a Sabaean. He was a builder. He built the shrine to, can I put it up here? He built the shrine to Janus, which is the god. They would open the doors in the temple of Janus when they were. That courage, and it let out rage. It let out conviction. It let out the emotions that men needed on the battlefield to fight. And in their existence of roughly 1,100 years for Western Rome, those temples weren't closed but just a handful of times. They were always fighting somewhere, always expanding the empire. Then you have, and he also formulated the College of Pontiffs, which is the College of Priests. He's followed by Tullius Hostilius. Now, Tullius was a conqueror. He went back to Alba Longa, that city, but Alba Longa and them were kind of be like Jacob and Esau fighting. So the decision was made, instead of working 2 armies together and slaughterhousing each other, we'll take 3 men, 3 brothers from Rome, and they would fight 3 brothers from Alba Longa, and the winner would be the victor. All 6 men fight, 5 of the 6 die, the one who is a Roman, I guess they won. That's kind of how that worked out. But they don't kill the Etruscans, they absorb them. This also becomes a Roman trait. Wiping out and destroying everybody doesn't do you any good. But the Etruscans had some skill. You bring them into the empire, much like I'm sure you dealt with yesterday with Daniel and their slaves with Nebuchadnezzar. You bring in, they become an asset. So they would begin to absorb this other empire. But he was rash. He was considered impious. He wasn't a very religious man. Supposedly he offered a sacrifice without following the instructions of the gods. And he got hit by a lightning bolt. It killed him. He died. So, again, you've got some myth mixed in with some historical stuff. As they try to explain Aesop's fables and so forth, there's a lot of truth in some of those. But then there's a little bit of a divergence from the truth. But they're trying to make a point. So you kind of have some of this as well. The next one is Ancus Marcius. He was peaceful. He took the mouth of the river Tyre, the Tiber River, which is big. Bigger than that, he built a bridge over the Tiber River. Can you imagine crossing a bridge, a river, on foot? So he built a bridge. You know what that does? Everybody in that area would walk to Rome, one side of the river or the other, to cross over. It brought all the commerce in the days to Rome. We've all heard the phrase, all roads lead to Rome. But this is kind of that idea. If you have transportation, you look at our great cities. All of our great cities are built on waterways for the most part and or railroad lines. They've got to be something coming through to make money. So this is what his major contribution. He also wrote the law. Now, the public people, but they came up with the law, and the judges at least have it. And then he also created prisons. Lucius Tarquinius, he's actually a pretty good king. He's called Tarquinius the Elder. Again, lots of reforms, lots of building, lots of construction. He built the temple to Jupiter. He builds I can't see it. The Circus Magnus. We've all seen the Circus Magnus if you've seen Ben-Hur. That's that big oblong stadium where they had the chariot races. Okay? That thing, as I looked it up last week, is 2,000 meters long and 100, so it's 500 yards wide, or 500 meters wide. It's 1,400 meters long. It's huge. The biggest stadium ever built. Says you can hold between 150 and 300,000. I don't think they had that many, but that's a big bunch. He built that. And it's even today, when you go and you see the ruins, you sit there and you just go, how? How did you do that with just manpower? Hammer, block and tackle. I'm going to diverge here just a second. But the Romans are the ones that figured out that 10 men can move a one-ton stone. But 5 men with one pulley can move a one-ton stone. But with 2 pulleys, 2 men can move a one-ton stone. They did it all the time. The guys were thinkers. You know, we think about them on the battlefield. That's a small part of it. But they were engineers to the core and great builders. So they build that. Of course, he's having lots of success. Because of that, he winds up getting assassinated. Rome has this love-hate relationship with their leaders. They don't like monarchs. You're going to see the next one. Now, Servius Tullius is kind of interesting. Servius Tullius was a slave. Very talented, very smart, raised by Tarquinius to be the next king, and he became the next king. Had great success, lots of reform, built a lot of things. He created the census. That's massive. Because until you know who you can't really function as a government, but by having a census, he was able to divide the people based on wealth. That's how taxes are calculated. So he has 3 classes, the equestrians. That's the rich guys with the horses. That's the cavalry. When we go to war, they show up on their horses with their weapons. They're ready to fight. They're going to become the nobles and leaders. You've got the foot soldiers, the army. That's the landowners. That's the farmers. That's the ranchers. That's the guys that have land. They bring their own weapons. And they line up. They fight. Then they're fighting in phalanxes. They'll move to legions later. You got the poor. They don't have nothing. But we can use them too. That's our auxiliary forces and or our laborers. Somebody got to dig those ditches. You know, so he puts them all to work in the system there with them. And his biggest thing, maybe the Servian Wall, which was a 7.5-mile wall that connected all 7 hills. For the first time, they're all behind the wall. Those walls could not be penetrated. When you, back in antiquity, you couldn't take castles. That's why they built them everywhere. They were basically impregnable. Rome is about the only engineering force that could go conquer a walled city or a walled palace. Until Attila the Hun shows up in the 400s and does it to them later. By the way, he stole their business. But this was a big deal to get that wall around there. He is thrown down, though, and killed on the steps. And his daughter apparently ran her chariot over him. She and her husband, his stepson, took over. And that was Tarquinius Superbus. And he was not a real good guy. He goes again. He leads another campaign against the Etruscans. And his son rapes a woman named Lucretia. And she's very well known. When the event's over, calls her husband, calls the household. She's terribly ashamed of the situation, commits suicide. That causes a massive uproar back in Rome. They are done. These monarchs have got to go. Now, I find it somewhat ironic. That's about the same time that Greece going toward democracy. There's a movement across that part of the world to get rid of kings, but that at least is the excuse. They're immoral. They're not what they're supposed to be, and they're king. And that is the birth of the Republic in 509 B.C. That's whenever that takes place. Now, that's really nice and cool, but we have this Republic. They don't have it under really going very well yet, and they begin to have outside pressure put upon them. In 490, the Celts, not the ones you think about in England before they crossed over, they think more of Gaul, think more of Western France. They come down, they attack Rome, and they take the city. And they loot the city. owed it for several months, and they finally ransom the city back to the people, and then they go home. And historically, that's where you see a change in Roman culture, from just building walls and developing their cities to where the military becomes the face of Rome. It is a defensive position. They understand for the first time they are vulnerable to that kind of attack. And they say no more. And their first thing they want to do is put buffers around us. So they're going to go take the Latins first. I'm going to speed this up for time's sake. They take the Latins first. Then they take the Semites. Then they fight the Etruscans up north. Then they turn their attention south to fight the Greeks, greater Greece. Now, the Greeks, now this sounds more political. Somehow, accidentally, 10 Roman ships sailed into one of the harbors that is there in greater Greece. Well, greater Greece sinks them. That's what we do when ships show up in the harbor. Rome then says, hey, you got to pay us for those boats and for all that lost trade goods and all those men. And Greece says, kiss our foot. They didn't say it that way. But they said no. And they send word to Greece, send us an army. So Pyrrhus is sent. That's spelled real funny. It's P-Y. I'm going to look it up. But anyway, he's sent from Greece, and he comes with a large army, and he's going to meet them. They're going to fight with the Romans, and he does destroy the Romans. The first battle is at Halicarnassus, and the second one is at Esquilium, and this is a 279. And these two battles ends them, but the blood loss is terrible. He has the famous quote, you ever heard of a Pyrrhic victory? Yeah, that means you won the battle, but what? You lost the war. He says, one more victory like this, and we'll be ruined. I mentioned the South earlier. You know, when the Yankees and the Confederates fought, if there were 20,000 dead on both sides, the Yankees won. Because there ain't that many men in the South. So that's the situation here. There weren't that many Greeks here to pull from. So finally, they wind up having to surrender. And so now Rome more or less has all of the Italian boot. But there's another force, 265. There is another, no, 165. There is another force in the Western Med, and that's a place called Carthage. Now, Carthage, in your mind, see Egypt on your map, in your Bible map, and on the left side, running about 400 miles deep, along that northern coast of Africa, almost to the turn, is Carthage. Carthage also holds southern Hispania, which is Spain, the Iberian Peninsula. They also hold Sardinia and Sicily. They hold all of that region there. And Sicily is very important. Sicily is just right there next to Rome. So Rome decides that they don't like this idea of having Carthage so close. Now, Carthage, by the way, is not a warlike nation. Carthage is a money-making nation. They're economic giants. But they have enough money to hire the best mercenaries in the world. Hire armies from Spain and from Gaul. When I say Gaul, see France in your mind. When I say Hispania, see Spain. And also Numidia. Numidia, North Africans, had some pretty good heavy foot soldiers and some very good cavalry groups. Okay, the North Africans had some pretty good soldiers in the antiquity. So they hire those guys, Carthage does, and they have a young man named Hannibal. Again, I skipped a generation to get to this point of the lesson. But Hannibal, first of all, the first time they fight him, they fight at Sardinia, and Carthage just wipes them out. Rome decides to fight Carthage over Sardinia. Sardinia first. Maybe it's Sardinia, the lower one by the hill. They're going to fight them first. But Rome is an army. They're land fighters. They are tough to the bone on flat ground. They don't know anything about boats. We built some boats. Okay, fine. Hop in there, hoss. They go out there. They just get slaughterhouse. It doesn't work out too good for them at all. But you know what Rome does do? Now we're back to our legend now. Rome doesn't quit. Rome does not make peace. Rome wins. Rome goes home, and they build some more boats. Rome comes back. They develop what's called a curvus. It looks like a bridge. They can wheel that thing up. They pull this bridge up along the mast, and that bridge has a big old stinger sitting out there, a big old metal, like a T-post on the end of it. And they come up to your boat, and they flop that bridge down, bam, and that T-post drives into your deck, and you are now attacked, and we now have land war again. And those legions run across there, those gluteuses and those pilums, their spears and swords, they slaughterhouse everybody. So they win the first Punic War. Second Punic War, now I'm at 165. We got Hannibal coming. Boy, I like Hannibal. Hannibal was some kind of general. He tries to do what hadn't been done. You think we got caught by surprise December 7th, 41, when they hit Pearl Harbor? Man, he crossed, first of all, from Carthage to Spain. Goes up the peninsula of Iberia, crosses the Pyrenees into Gaul, goes around the Horn, crosses now the Alps with 50,000 men and war elephants. And shows up in the army in central Italy. It's like, where did this come from? So Trebia, and they fight at Trebia, and 15,000 Roman soldiers are killed instantly. Just bam, bad day. That's a good day compared to what's coming next. Because what they do next, they meet him at Rome, builds the largest army they had ever assembled. They've got 86,000 soldiers ready for whenever they meet them at Cannae. This is in 216. Now, Hannibal, this is a brilliant tactician, and Rome's going to learn from this. When he meets them, he's got about 50,000 men, and he forms what are your reverse C. He bulges his line out in a circle, a half circle, facing the Romans. The Romans are on home ground. They've got almost 2-to-1 men. They're going to bring brute force, diesel power. They're going to march those thick, what they call the heavy block. The heavy legions, they're going to walk up there. It's shield to shield. We're going to put suckers into the ocean. So here they come. And they come in there, their men. They lock up. They push. Now, Hannibal instructed his men. He's in that big circle, a half circle. And on his wings, he's got those Numidian heavy foot soldiers, the best warriors he's got. He allows his center to sag. It's not going to break, but he sags. The Romans interpret that, hey, we are kicking these guys to the curb. They just attack. They push in. As they push, that rascal sinks down. As it gets to the sea facing him now and is full of Romans, the wings, which are heavily fortified, swing around and engulf the Romans. Make it worse, the Numidian cavalry, who had run the Romans off the field earlier, has circled back per his instructions, and now they crash into the backside of the army as well. 86,000 men. The reports from this and from Livy and Ovid, some of the other writers, as they would go through this, they were wedged in there so tightly, they couldn't even raise their arms with a sword. For the rest of the day, 9 hours, it took them 9 more hours to kill every Roman in that circle. Now, a few of them broke out, but for the most part, they killed them all. It took a day. Over 70,000 dead in 1 day. Now, any sane people would have sued for peace. They would have said, hey, what can we give you Sardinia back? Can we give you Sicily? Is there a way we can pay y'all off and let us go home? They didn't do that. In fact, the Senate outlawed the word peace after that battle. So what they did, they elected a man whose name was, make sure I get his name right. I really like this guy. I know his sub is the delayer. I got ahead of myself by one. No, here we go. Quintus Fabius Maximus. Quintus is put in. He's an older general, very wise. He knows we can't whip that guy. Some of you guys old enough to remember Mike Tyson at 19 or 20, don't stand in front of him. It ain't going to work, right? Well, don't stand in front of Hannibal. You ain't beating this cat. He's good. And he's got these elephants. We don't understand that. We don't savvy that yet. I hadn't figured that one out. So what he does, he fights like, I mentioned Houston earlier, like General Houston. And down here in Texas, there was a lot of pressure. You need to stand and fight, stand and fight, stand and fight. He said, my army's got one battle in it. And that ain't it. We can't meet Santa Ana on open land. Well, this guy who harassed it, he attacks the baggage. He kind of hips around the curve. You know, he hits him at the fight. While he keeps him occupied, there's another man, Publius Scipio, who you probably know as Scipio Africanus, but we're not to Africa yet, but he's going there. He was a survivor of Cannae. He's seen this up front. He understands what he's facing. He gets the Senate to allow him to make a stop in southern Hispania so he can cut off their supply lines and then invade Carthage. He can't beat him in Italy, so he goes to Carthage, and he attacks the city of Carthage. Well, he gets what he thought he wanted, which is they send word, I think it's 202, actually, and they have Hannibal recalled. Got him out of Italy. Well, he's going to meet him again, this time at Alesia. Let me double check. No, it's at Zama. Now, the plains of Zama, and the Romans are outnumbered, but he's got a good army. He's about 75,000 strong, roughly 100,000 Carthaginians, 80 war elephants. Here they come. Well, this time, Scipio, rather than line up those Roman legions or have that strong front line, he flips them vertical. He has long lines of Romans with big gaps between them. So when the elephants are coming, there's no line to run through. And he also has armed a bunch of his guys with trumpets. When they get close, that horn, and you scare those elephants. Some of them ran backwards. The rest of them just ran down. It's kind of like a cow. They go run to daylight. They didn't go into the troops. They went on down the line. Well, then the troops reform, attack the Carthaginians. Battle's nip and tuck for a while until the Numidian cavalry, whom Scipio has paid to fight for him this time, come running in again on the backside of an army, and they crush the Carthaginians. Hannibal escapes with his life. He goes off, and he's a kind of a mercenary general for hire for a while. And then he goes on and commits suicide later. But that makes Scipio extremely famous. Now, there's a big change taking place right here that I want to focus on. And you're going to see it. This is what's going to kill the Republic. This is the shift to where you begin to... Oh, I got to pick it up. I got 15 on mine. Okay. But this is the shift. Yeah, you're 5. You're 10. You're 5 fast. 10:30 to... Anyway, look at that. You start having generals that are very, very famous with the men. It's not the Senate. See, back in the day, they were all land-owning Romans who were fighting for Rome. Now I'm fighting for my general. Scipio comes home. Now, he didn't cross his mind to take power. It's going to cross some other ones later. Marius comes next. Marian reforms, whole good stuff you can say about Marian. His biggest reforms were, he passed these guys. I can use those bodies. I need them. So he's fighting the Gallics. He's fighting the what we call French. So these non-land-holding men fight. Here's the change. Now, it doesn't take place right now. But if I hire you and you're a farm boy with no land, and I will pay you if and when we win, are you fighting for Rome or are you fighting for me? So Marius's army is Marius's army. Sulla is going to come next. So is his army. So is Julius Caesar. I'll fast forward this. Marius becomes famous through his victories. He wins there in North Africa. This is in 105. He fights King Gargatha, beats him. That move made the army much stronger. It makes the idea of the Republic much weaker. It's going to undermine that quickly. He's elected consul 7 times in a row. It was just 1 year, supposedly. He's elected 7 years in a row. Lucius Cornelius Sulla rises next. Sulla is over in 83 fighting against Mithridates over in the east. Very, very rich area. Everybody wants to go east. All the Persians had all the money. That's where Alexander had landed. That's where the Babylonians were. That's where the Persians were. That's where the money was. Because when you conquered, you stole. You had it all. So Sulla is told by Marius, y'all stop. You hold the ground. Me and my army are coming and finish them off. It says that, forget that. They went there and got the gold for themselves. So now you got a conflict between those two. So then Marius goes ahead and begins to kill a bunch of Sulla's supporters back in Italy. Sulla gets back. Marius runs off like a girl. They actually found him in a swamp standing neck deep in mud trying to hide from being caught when they got him. But anyway, that's another story. Sulla goes in. He has his purges, wipes out most of the Marian supporters. There is a young Marian supporter named Julius Caesar. Doesn't get killed in the purges. So we have Sulla becomes dictator, which they had dictators, and that was the Senate. They would pass that power to you because in times of war, even like our president, there are things you can do when you need to do it quickly to do things like that. But when the war was over, Sulla gave it back. The most prominent men at that time are Crassus. I skipped 73 B.C. A slave named Spartacus leads a revolt against the people. There are 100,000 slaves join him. 2 years later, Crassus, the richest senator in Rome, destroys him, becomes famous. Pompey, or Pompey, goes out to the Med, clears all the pirates out. He becomes famous. Julius Caesar has been manipulating things behind the scenes. He's pretty people. He becomes famous. So we have the first triumvirate, triple, control of the power. Caesar puts in to go to Gaul, northern Gaul. Why would you go there? That land is not settled. The Germans are up there. The Gauls are there. It's rough country. He knows, though, if he goes there, there's more glory to be had there than robbing old men over in Persia. Well, Persia is where Pompey goes, gets more money, and they kind of put the other guy. Crassus goes east, I should say, and Pompey stays put. Crassus gets over there. He loses the battle of the Parthians, or what they're called at this stage. The Parthians defeat him, and they capture him. He's a very rich guy. He's a very covetous guy. He's people in wars. Down, milk gold and pour it down his throat. That's how he dies. Well, Julius Caesar, all he does is defeat Vercingetorix. It's a great battle, by the way. He runs, he's up on a hill. He fortified behind this great wall. Caesar comes with his army and builds a traditional Roman trench around it, Roman earthworks around it. Vercingetorix had gotten word out. 250,000 great Gallic warriors show up and surround Julius Caesar. So he's a nut. He's got an enemy in front of him. He's got an enemy behind him. Anybody else would sue for peace. Not Julius Caesar. He orders the men to turn around and build a wall on this side. So he's got two defensive positions. He takes both armies at one at a time. And then Vercingetorix comes out, lays his sword down, surrenders. There's lots of artwork about that. He is coming. Done yet? just to see what it looks like, he crosses the channel and does an exploratory interview of the Great Britain. Then he comes back and he goes to the Danube. Nope, the Rhine. He's on the eastern side. The northern kingdom, the northern borders, were the Rhine on the west, and you had the Danube on the east, which went back up toward the Balkans. The Rhine River, where he's going to cross it, is over 400 feet long, 30 feet deep, and very swift. The Germans were safe behind the river. You couldn't get to them. There are friendly Germanic tribes offering him boats. He didn't want any boats. I don't know if y'all heard what he said or not. He builds a 400 feet long, 30 feet wide bridge. They do it by off of a barge. They tie a bunch of limbs together, make rafts. They drive it. I got 10. That is wrong. They drove these pylons in to the river at an angle. These poles, trees. They didn't bring them with them. They cut them out of the woods. 30 feet of water, had to get at least 10 feet down. These are 40, 50 feet long telephone poles. They drive them into the floor of that river, all the way down there, put boards on it. They have it leaning to where the way they lean, the water pressure itself tightens the bridge. They march across. When they get over there, that big German army has run for the mountains. They don't know what this is. In 10 days, that's the largest bridge ever built, by the way, in the world at that time. They cross the Rhine River. He spends 10 days just doing what he wants to in Germany. Comes back, picks it up as they come back, and burns it. He's going home. Well, the Senate freaks out. I'm going to fast forward the rest of this. The Senate freaks out. They say, hey, disband your army and you come down here and talk to us. Well, he's in northern Italy at that Rubicon River. It was against Roman law to bring an army into the Roman city. Well, he ain't going to surrender. So he famously says, behold, the die is cast. Some versions say in the Latin, the die is cast high. He took the dice, just roll the dice, boys. If God's with us, we're going to take over Rome. If not, we're going to go out in a blaze of glory. Well, they all ran. There was nobody to fight. They come in unopposed. Pompey ran over to Greece. Now, it's not Greece now, but it's Roman province. But it goes to that area to raise an army to come back and fight Caesar. Caesar and he are going to... Caesar defeats him. He hops in a boat, runs to Egypt. He goes to Ptolemy's. He thinks he'll get support there. He gets off his boat and gets there. Ptolemy the Eighth and his sister Cleopatra meet him. And Caesar's on his tail. When Caesar gets there, they're having dinner with Caesar. They give him the head. They kill Pompey and give his head to Caesar. He then makes Cleopatra the queen. Cleopatra, by the way, is brilliant. She speaks 10 languages. Beautiful, apparently. She has a child with him named Caesarion. That's in 46. 45, he goes back to Rome. Big triumphant entry, same dictator for life, but the Senate can't swallow that. They are the descendants, Brutus in particular, descendants of the great king killers from back in the monarch days. And Rome is not supposed to be ruled by a king. One day, 44, the Ides of March, March 15th of 44 BC, he comes to the Senate. They surround him. He's stabbed 23 times. Mark Antony does the eulogy. He lays the body out there. Of course, Shakespeare captures this for us and kind of embellishes it somewhat. But he was stabbed, according to Shakespeare. He says, et tu, Brute? Brutus was a friend of his. Marcus is going through this, Mark Antony, this great funeral about this great man of the people. He reads a will, he wrote it himself, but he reads a will that says, Caesar was going to give y'all all the land. He loved y'all. Look what they did to him. And there's the most unkindest cut of all, the stab of Brutus, as if you could tell which one was Brutus's. But it plays well, and the people want to kill all the senators that were involved in that. Civil War breaks out. Second, the triumphant that comes up is Caesar. We already did that one. The second triumphant, Mark Antony, and that's his nephew, and Lepidus. They send Lepidus to North Africa. Octavian stays in the Roman western area, and Mark Antony goes to Alexandria, goes to Egypt. He falls in bed with Cleopatra. They have two kids. He makes war against Octavian, who meets him at the battle. The most important battle of that part of the world, another naval battle. Big, slow-moving ships from Egypt fight slow, fast-moving ships from Rome. Dead water, no wind. Providence or not, I don't know, but those big ships won't move. Little ships fire, they win the battle. Mark Antony runs to Egypt, commits suicide. In the poetic version, Cleopatra is there, has him laid out beside her, takes an ass, puts it to her breast. That snake bites her, she dies, they're both dead. Octavian goes back to Rome, is declared Augustus Caesar. You know, that's Augustus, great one, Caesar, taking that name. That name Caesar, since the day Caesar lived, has been venerated by men. All the Caesars that follow, all the Kaisers are the Tsars. Those are Russian and German versions of that same name. At his death, Octavius, in effect, becomes emperor. It does not mean what emperor means now, the empire situation here. He was just the first man. He becomes emperor. Augustus, real fast, is a great Caesar. Builds Rome, makes the legion, expands the borders to everything that you see in our area now. He's going to be followed up by Tiberius. Tiberius is one of the stepsons of his third wife, Drusilla. He's a pretty good king. He's just not there. Caligula is a madman. They named Caligula just for your perusal. It means little boots. When he was a little bitty guy, the soldiers, he had a little pair of boots, ran around the army, and they said, hey, little boots. He hated the name. That was his name, madman. He was killed. Claudius was a pretty good reformer, kind of weak. He had a limp. They didn't care for him much. Nero, the fool who burned down the city, is assassinated by the Praetorian Guard. In 68, the Julian line, Caesar's line, dies. Next, we run across 4 years of the same kings. You have Otho, you have Galba, you have Vitellian in 68, 69. But 70, you have Vespasian. Vespasian calms things down, reasserts some authority in Rome, builds a Colosseum. Titus comes in, finishes the Colosseum. Domitian comes next. He's a persecutor. Then you get to the five good kings. You've got Nerva, Trajan, Marcus Aurelius, Anthony Pius, and Hadrian. All those are good men for various reasons. Trajan is the one who martyred Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius writes the seven letters that you can read of Ignatius. He writes those, sends the brethren at Rome so they can be there at his execution. All these men were put in based on merit. They weren't kin to each other. Marcus Aurelius, maybe the smartest one in the group, for whatever reason, breaks that, puts his son Commodus in there. Commodus is a fool, 177. He winds up being finally killed. He becomes a gladiator. He thinks it's something special. He's really not. They have another gladiator named Narcissus, choked him to death, and they get rid of him. Here's what happens going forward. You have pressure from the north. All these tribes, the Germanic tribes, the French tribe, the Gauls, the Visigoths, the Vandals, they start pressing south. There's one Vandal in particular his name is Gasseric. Gasseric winds up taking all what used to be Carthage. Long story short, the empire is divided. Constantine comes along. Constantine is the one who passes the Edict of Toleration, so Christianity is tolerated, no longer persecuted. It's legal. 3 or 4 years later, he passes the Edict of Milan, where Christianity becomes the religion of the Roman Empire. In 325, he calls the Council of Nicaea for the pontiffs. Y'all get this doctrinal stuff fixed up. He's going to Canaan to be baptized, the same river Christ was when he gets sick. And they practice what's called clinical baptism, put him in a bed and pour water on him. Sadly, he never became a Christian, as far as I can determine. But nonetheless, he did, quote, Christianize the world in that sense. The Bibles we have today, the stuff that we have today, much of that comes from that. Fast forward, these Germans keep coming. Gasser's finally going to sack the city in 453, burns it down, loots it out. There's a few pretenders here and there, but by 470, it's gone. Constantinople, they had divided the city, the kingdom into two empires, with the Western Rome and Constantinople, the eastern half. That persists until 1455 when the Muslims, the Ottomans, come over. I think it's Mehmed II who finally conquers them. And from that time forward, it's been a Muslim state. And they changed the name in 1930 to Istanbul, which is where. But brethren, the world we're in, the church that we're sitting in right now, I'm talking about the Lord's church, was much formulated by a restoration movement trying to go further than what the reformers did. The reformers were reacting to the sins and the corruptions in the Catholic Church, and that is a Roman Catholic Church. Everything we see around us has the fingerprints of Rome on it even today. And that's all I can do in the time that Rick gave me. Thank you for your attention.